There's a bill on Missouri Governor Jay Nixon's desk this morning that deals with foreign laws. The sponsors have made clear that they're talking about Sharia, or Islamic law. Kansas passed a similar law last year, so have about 20 or so other states. Why all the fuss about a legal code that says Muslims must give money to the poor, or that they can't eat certain meat, that they should wash in certain ways? This is Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. We're talking today about Sharia law and about the legislative activity in the United States that has gone on in the last decade around it and continues here this year. Some say it's bigotry, plain and simple. Others say Sharia is a real threat, especially when it comes to what it says about marriage and divorce and the punishment, even the ultimate punishment, that it doles out for certain offenses. We'll get to the politics in the second part of today's show, but before we go there, let's step back and find out simply what Sharia is and what role it has in the day-to-day lives of the Muslim community around the world and here in Kansas City. To help us, we're joined by Raj Bala. He's the Rice Distinguished Professor at the University of Kansas School of Law. Raj, good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for hosting this program.
Well, thank you for being here. He's joining us from KPR Studios in Lawrence. We're also joined by Manaz Shabir here in our studios. She's active in the local Muslim community and a past president of the Heartland Muslim Council. Welcome to you.
Thank you. Thank you. Good morning to everyone.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
So, Raj Bala from KU Law School, let me start with you. What is Sharia?
Sharia means Islamic law, and in the old Arabic, it actually meant a path. And it's a path that would mean an all-encompassing way of life that ultimately leads back to God.
And is it a matter of doctrine, or is it a matter of practice? What is its role in the life of Islam?
It's both. It's a set of teachings that is based on four sources, and those teachings are to be practiced as best as one can in one's life. So the basic sources are the Holy Quran, tradition of the Prophet Muhammad, and it's traditionally said to be respectful by saying after Muhammad you say peace be upon him. So it's understood whenever I, you know, refer to the Prophet PBUH. That's the second source. So what he did and what he said, and then the consensus of scholars is the third source. Over the years, scholars have written many great treatises about the doctrines, the precepts. And then the fourth source is reasoning, specifically reasoning by analogy that scholars have used. And through those four sources, there's a large and comprehensive or fairly comprehensive body of doctrines that Muslims are called to implement in their daily lives. And they do that through practices like the famous five pillars of Islam. You referred to one of them in your introduction about giving alms.
So, Manaz Shabir, when kids grow up as Muslims, do they learn about Sharia from an early age? How big a part of the Muslim experience is Sharia?
Right. Well, let me just do two examples of Sharia. I'll say Salaam Alaikum. That means peace be unto you in Arabic. That is a way of how we greet each other. And then when we start anything, we always say Bismillah Ar-Rahman Ar-Rahim, which means in the name of God, the most beneficent, the most merciful. So, yeah, those two things, we start off with our kids right away.
And that's Sharia. That's
Sharia.
Not just a habit. That's actually something that's embedded in this legal code of Muslim practice.
Yeah, and it's like Raj was just talking, it is a way of life. So whenever we eat any food or, you know, even coming to the studio this morning and getting in the car, you know, I say a little prayer, Bismillah Ar-Rahman Ar-Rahim, and off I go. And so I'm incorporating Sharia even as I'm dressed in front of you. I'm wearing a headscarf. I ate halal food this morning, which is the way our food is prepared. And so it's part of the way of life for all Muslims.
Raj, how comparable is Sharia to other religious traditions' legal codes? Is it like Torah in Jewish practice? Is it like how a Christian might think of the commands of Jesus?
Yes and no. in the sense that not every single detailed doctrine and not every single way in which a doctrine is practiced is precisely the same. For example, as Manaz was suggesting, eating halal food, well, the way halal food is prepared may be different from the way kosher food is prepared, or the way that there's fasting during Ramadan may be different from the way there's fasting for Christians during Lent. But yes, in a very big way, in its underlying impulses and underlying basic ideas, thrusts, there's tremendous similarity. I mean, when we look at these four sources that we discussed earlier and what Islamic law is trying to get at, basically it shares with the other Abrahamic traditions monotheism, a belief in one God. Second, it shares a belief in a day of judgment, that there will come a time when each of us will be called to account to that one God for what we've done in our lives, and have we tried to do our best. And third, there's a belief, again shared with the Abrahamic faiths, that God intervenes for reasons known only to him in the course of human history to help us guide us back to him.
So, Manaz, it sounds to me like Sharia is a very broad, encompassing term. It isn't a document. It isn't just a particular itemized list of things to do and do not do.
Yeah, and I would, if you ask my boys, I have four boys, so are you doing Sharia today? They wouldn't even know what I'm talking about, right. Because that's not how we refer to it. So it's, like the five times a day prayer. We're getting close to Ramadan in July, doing our fasting, you know, the charity, making the pilgrimage. These are all practices of Muslims. You know, what becomes confusing, I think, is when you start to overlay the human aspects of this, which is more of the cultural issues that sometimes get the headline news and takes away the attention of what Islam is.
Well, I want to invite our listeners to be part of the conversation. What do you want to know about Islamic law? Or are there things you've heard that you want to check out? We also want to hear, especially from our Muslim listeners, what is Sharia for you and in your life and your faith practice? Call us at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. You can also tweet us at KCURCST. Raj Bala, you're a law professor. You actually teach a course on Islamic law, which suggests to me that there are some pretty involved and sort of technical aspects to what Sharia is. What would you say are sort of the central legal principles, if you can put it that way, that underlie Sharia?
Well, let me put it this way. The central legal principles are to try and manifest in the various specialties of law, contracts, property, criminal law, family law, trusts and estates, banking law, international law, to try and corporate law or partnership law, to try and manifest in those fields the teachings that we get from those four basic sources, to try to bring closer together what we're doing in our public behavior through making contracts in the marketplace or through setting up bank accounts or investing, choosing investments, or dealing with marriages and divorces or dealing with criminal behavior, to try and make those practices in the public square, if you will, in accord with what we know from the four sources, from what God has revealed to us through his prophet.
And so as a legal system, does Sharia presume that everybody in society is abiding by these same principles, or can it be applied just to practicing Muslims?
The latter, just to practice, just to Muslims. The Sharia does not apply to non-Muslims. Non-Muslims can choose to follow Sharia practices or Sharia-like practices. And we saw the example of fasting is one of them. Another one is the movement recently, especially since the 2008 financial crash, towards more socially and ethically responsible investing. And we see a number of non-Muslim investors interested in more finding more ethical ways to invest. But it does not technically apply to them.
Manaz, when I hear Raj list those sorts of requirements or those sorts of underlying legal principles to Sharia, it doesn't sound really any different than not only other religious laws, but in some ways just sort of general ethical practice.
Absolutely.
What is so distinctive about it?
Well,
or is anything?
Well, I would just say that these are so to be a Muslim, there are things that you have to do to become a Muslim, and there's no compulsion in Islam. So there's nothing that's forcing anyone to be practicing the way we practice. If you did, then you wouldn't be a Muslim if you were being forced to do something. So you have to like submit to it and to God's will. What comes to mind right now is we're talking. I'm thinking, of course, what's happening in Oklahoma City, and I was remembering what happened in Joplin a couple of years ago. There's a Muslim clinic, a physician clinic, that was taking care of right then and there. They were taking care. They were doing triage at the clinic at the time of the tornado. And so even helping the needy, helping those that are less fortunate, these are practices of a Muslim, just like any other human being, how they would be.
Raj, a lot of the attention that Sharia gets, especially in some of the legislative conversations that we'll have in the second half of our show, seems to come around family disputes and sort of family law adjudication that might be connected with Sharia. What does Sharia have to say about family matters?
Well, Sharia prescribes rules on marriage, on the validity of marriage, on divorce and the methods of divorce, on the rights of a wife, on the rights of children and the obligations of parents towards children and vice versa. It also covers inheritance matters within the family, a narrow and extended family. So it provides a fairly a broad coverage of all of the things that we would normally expect families to engage in during their life. And that includes discussion of intimate behavior among a couple.
I should mention that you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Brian Ellison, and we're talking about Sharia, that is Islamic law, and its place in Muslim life abroad and here in the Kansas City area. Manaz Shabir, who is active in the local Muslim community, is with us, as well as Raj Bala, who's a professor at KU Law School. Raj, let me ask you this. Are there countries that use Sharia as the basis of their secular or their civil legal system in a way that would be unfamiliar to American listeners?
Yes. The thing, and to back up a little bit, I think what this goes back a little bit to an earlier question you asked is what's often puzzling, and Manaz also touched on this, to folks not familiar with the Sharia, is that as an all-encompassing way of life, the public-private distinction, the distinction between what we do in the public sphere and our private behavior in our homes, is not as strong because we're not taught by the Sharia precepts to compartmentalize our behavior, that behavior is just for Friday prayers, that's when we're holy, and then the rest of the 6 days of the week we just go out in our secular life. Where Sharia teaches to elide that distinction between public and private. Now, turning to your question, this is exactly the debate that is playing out in many parts of the Muslim world, particularly in the Arab Muslim world after the Arab Spring. I think one demographic point is worth mentioning here. There are roughly 1.3 to 1.5 billion Muslims in the world. Roughly 300 to 400 million are in the Arab Middle East. That means the vast majority are not in the Arab world. The largest Muslim country is Indonesia, and there are other major Muslim countries in Southeast Asia, such as Malaysia and a smaller one, Brunei. And I think it's important for listeners to understand that how your question is being played out really differs depending on what part of the world you're in, Indian subcontinent, Southeast Asia, or in the Arab Middle East. Now, in the Arab Middle East in particular, some countries do have Sharia as basically the constitution, and that's sort of the top-down legal system. And Saudi Arabia, a Sunnite nation, and Iran, a Shiite nation, would be the examples of that. Though even in those countries, there's a need for secular or modernist legislation to at least fill gaps and resolve issues that aren't necessarily covered directly by those four sources. In other countries, Tunisia, Algeria, Morocco, Egypt, after the Arab Spring, each of those is trying to decide exactly your question. What role, if any, shall Sharia play in our legal system? At one end, should it be an inspiration for our legal system, which where we have nothing that really conflicts with the Sharia, but we're basically a secular country and secular constitution? And one might draw an analogy to many Western democracies there. On the other hand, do we want a much more overt role for the Sharia, apropos the examples of Saudi Arabia or Iran? And that's what many of these countries are debating in their new democratic environment.
Manaz Shabir, I know you don't speak for all Muslims in the United States, but you're certainly familiar with the community here in the Kansas City area. Can you imagine a scenario where Sharia would be actually incorporated into civil legal practices here?
Well, like what was mentioned earlier, like a marriage, how we do our wedding, nikah, it's the legal terminology of the marriage, or how we do our burials. There's a way that we do a washing. I mean, it's similar to the Jewish faith of washing and how we do the burial. So my point of saying all this is that we live our life and we don't even look at this is like Sharia or what. We just know this is our religious way of practice and this is how we want to be. Now, what I will say, too, is that the U.S. Constitution allows us to do all this. There isn't anything the U.S. Constitution makes it with a freedom of religion that we can just practice, just like any other religion practicing.
Right. Well, and I wanted to ask about that. We actually had an email from Gabby. She emailed us at centralstandard@kcur.org. She said, what happened to being able to freely practice the religion of your choice in the U.S. under the Constitution? How is practicing Sharia law any different to Hasidic Jews or fundamental Christians or any more conservative part of a major religion? If Christians and Jews expect their religious practices to be respected and honored, how can we not also honor Islamic law? Is she speaking for the Muslim community?
Absolutely.
There?
I mean, any religion has rules and practices of how to be of that faith. And so if we start to focus on one, then we're actually including everybody in that whole bucket. And why is it just focusing on one? I mean, that is another issue that you haven't gotten into yet. And, you know, right now Islam has a target on the back. There are people that want to rally around the anti-Muslim Islamophobia conversation just to get people scared. And what we have to do, and I'm glad you wanted to do this show, is the way that we can address fear is by education. So let's put some more education out there.
Well, let's invite our listeners to be part of that education. What do you need to know about Sharia? What do you find strange or surprising about it? What makes you concerned, if something makes you concerned about it? Call us. Let's talk about it at 816-235-2888. 235-2888. You can also tweet us at KCURCST. Raj, there actually are some Western countries that have at least on some level incorporated elements of Islamic law into their practice. I'm thinking of British courts, family arbitration types of courts, right?
Well, I'm not sure that any Western country has actually overtly incorporated elements of Sharia into their legal systems. In fact, some have actually gone more the other way. Their burqa bans, for example, in France, which are being enforced on the streets of French cities. I think the example you mentioned is most notable and clear in India. Under the Indian constitution, religious minorities, and that is not limited to Islam, it would include Jains and Parsis and Sikhs, they, if they choose to do so, can resolve family law and certain other issues. It's defined jurisdictionally to certain issues through their own processes, their own religious processes. And as long as those resolutions are not inconsistent with the Indian constitution, that's fine. And that's actually both historically and economically a smart thing to do, because in the Indian context, because historically, of course, and to this day, India is a tremendously religiously pluralistic society, and its court system is quite clogged. So if the if every last dispute were to go into the Indian secular courts, they'd be behind even further in their dockets. So why not let the religious groups in India arbitrate and adjudicate certain of their disputes? Right. The idea you mentioned has been proposed in some other countries. Britain is one of them. I think it's also been suggested in Ontario in the past. To go back to one point that I think is so important, what Manaz said, the importance of education. What we're really combating here, and I realize you haven't quite gotten into this yet, in terms of this problem is one. It's a problem of prejudice, and the way to combat it is education.
Well, let's try to do a little of that education here. We've got a number of calls asking questions about what is Sharia. Let's start with Gene in Shawnee. Gene, good morning. Welcome to Central Standard.
Good morning. I appreciate the show and the dealing with this subject. I teach counselors how to effectively work with diverse populations, and a question often comes up. And of course, I understand that it's the media that plays up the implementation of Sharia in its extreme form, perhaps, you know, where women are being stoned in arenas and that type of thing for, let's say, an infraction such as adultery or whatever. And I think the other issue is multiple marriages. The question that I have is, what are moderate Islamic groups doing? And I understand the educational process. That's very important. So when we hear, to counteract that media attention to the extreme implementation of what maybe radical groups call the implementation of Sharia, and it becomes a spectacle sort of in the media arena.
Sure. Your question, Gene, is what's kind of the difference between the radical interpretation and a more moderate interpretation, right?
Yeah, that's a good rephrase. Yeah.
Okay, Manaz, in your experience, where do you see the disconnect? How do we get from one to the next?
Again, thank you, Gene, for your question. And the issue again, it has to have this cultural overlay on top of any religion. So if you're a Christian, how you practice, for example, Christmas here in America is going to be different than how maybe a German in Germany it practices Christmas. So in that same sense, we have to understand there's this cultural overlay on religion. And as we just heard, there's 1.3 billion Muslims in the world, and we're not all equal. Even in my own household or my with my brothers, how I practice is going to be a little different than how my brothers practice. So, I mean, we're very diverse. And if you were to say, okay, all Muslims wear a sign, I mean, we come in all shapes and sizes and colors and creeds. And so we're all going to be different. The thing is, again, not to say that when you hear or read something that happens in another country, that this is an example of how Muslims in America are living, because you know, you've got about 7 million of us now here, and half of them, about half, are African American Muslims, and the other half are like first generation Muslims, like myself, born in the U.S., raised, and all my education has been here and acclimated here. So you've got the best of both worlds. You've got an American who abides by the U.S. Constitution, and you have someone who's practicing Islam, who is trying to do the best in my community as well as for my family and for myself.
You know, I wonder, Manaz, we talked about one misconception a little earlier, the misconception that that Sharia is supposed to apply to everyone and not just Muslims. Are there other misconceptions that come to mind for you that you seem to encounter when people talk about Sharia?
Oh, well, yeah. Well, first of all, let me just say there isn't any Muslim group that has asked for Sharia law in the United States. I just want to underscore that. There's no Muslim organization that has asked for this. We don't need this. We don't need to have something like this.
And you don't need it because you feel like it's already protected.
Yes. The U.S. Constitution is taking care of me. I can practice. This is what's so great about the United States. I can practice my religion any way I want to, and nobody is going to tell me that I can or cannot do this or that. Now, if I'm in another country, just like we were talking about France, that I wouldn't be able to go into like a public area because I wear a headscarf, I wouldn't want to be there.
Let's take one more call before our break from Linister in the Volcker neighborhood. Linister, welcome to Central Standard.
Yes, thank you. As I understand it, the Muslims believe in all the prophets.
Yes, we do.
Which would be, as a Muslim would say it, Abraham, Jesus, and Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon all of their names.
Yes.
Which I think is a wonderful custom. And also, I wish to point out, there's no pope in the Muslim world. There's no hierarchy. But a Muslim believes between him and God.
That's right. We have a direct relationship. I can, like, when it's time for my prayer, around another couple hours here, I just have to look at the time for my afternoon prayers, I can just find out the direction towards Mecca, which was built by Prophet Abraham, peace be upon him, and then just start doing my prayers directly to Allah, which is the Arabic word for God.
Linister,
I think it's wonderful, by the way. Thank you.
Thank you for the call. I was just going to follow up really quickly. He mentioned there is not a pope in Islam. Who's the final authority in interpreting Sharia anyway?
Well, again, it's going to be different based on the – just like in Christianity, you have different sections. So in the Sunni sect, there's several, and so they'll have a hierarchy of some kind there that will help in the community. And in the Shia faith, they have marjas or ayatollahs that help with that as well.
Great. Well, we do need to take a break. When we come back, we're going to find out what all the fuss is about. Kansas, maybe 20-some other states have considered and passed laws that would ban Sharia being used in the U.S. Would Sharia ever be used in the U.S.? Missouri's governor has a bill waiting for his signature. What's this whole thing about? Should he sign it? You're still welcome to join our conversation. Call us at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. That's what's ahead when our conversation continues, so stay with us. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. And welcome back to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Brian Ellison. We're talking today about Islamic law, or Sharia, in the first half of our show. We covered what it is and what it is not. We're still joined by law professor Raj Bala from KU. He teaches a class on Islamic law and is also associate dean for international and comparative law. We're also still joined by Manaz Shabir. She is past president of the Heartland Muslim Council, also very active in the local interfaith community. But we want to turn now to how some states and legislators are responding. They say they see Sharia as a threat to democracy and freedom, and laws have been passed, including one last year in Kansas and one now awaiting the governor's signature here in Missouri, to ban it. Ryan Boyer graduated this past weekend from the University of Kansas School of Law, I guess a student of Raj Bala's. Ryan was a member of the Kansas Law Review. His article on Kansas anti-Sharia legislation will be published this summer in the Kansas Journal of Law and Public Policy, and he joins us by phone this morning. Good morning, Ryan.
Good morning. I just want to say something. Thank you so much for having me. And also, my
article will be published in the Kansas Law Review, not the Journal of Law and Public Policy.
My mistake. Thanks for the correction. Let's start with sort of some background on before even we get to the Kansas anti-Sharia legislation. How did these laws start to be discussed across the country?
Well, I think that after 9/11, and Ms. Shabir points this out, that there's this fear and a fear of the unknown that has just run rampant across the country. So I think that the fear of Muslim and extreme Islam beliefs have really sparred this legislation. And this has been these ideas of banning foreign law, specifically Sharia, is not novel. It is something that has come up in the national scene in the Senate and the House, and starting as early as 2004 and going to 2009, there have been several bills trying to be passed that implement a ban on Sharia law or foreign law to be considered by the judiciary.
Now, and as you say, these laws have been sort of developing over the course of many years in different places and to some degree on the federal level. Has there been an evolution, a change in what the laws sought to do from the first attempts or the first laws to the ones that are now like those being considered in Missouri and the one that just passed in Kansas last year?
I think that the biggest change that we've seen is the shift from going from the national forum to the state level, because the driving proponents behind these bills have had trouble. I think it's as many as 7, 8, or 9 attempts to pass it at the federal level, but they see the state legislatures as being more malleable and easier to get this legislation in. So I think that that's the biggest wave that we're seeing right now, is these easily influenced state legislatures being caught up in this fear and paranoia that just isn't there. And then they're passing these bills that have this wide impact on people, regardless if they're Muslim or not.
Well, I do want to talk about those motivations, whether it be fear or paranoia or legitimate concern, as well as the impact of these laws on the local community. But let's start by talking about the specific content of the law. The law that passed in Kansas is known as Article 51. What does Article 51 say, Ryan?
Well, basically, Article 51 prohibits any judge from enforcing or relying upon any foreign law, legal code, or system to make or base its ruling.
Okay.
And
any foreign
language,
law. So does it even mention Sharia?
No, it doesn't. And that language is as sweeping and as broad as you think it is. And so it could impact people who are trying to reconciliate problems using the Christian coalition system, using biblical arbitration. It could influence how Orthodox Jews handle their arbitrations in family disputes. It has more of a sweeping impact than proponents of these bills think.
But you think that goes beyond the intent of the authors of the bills?
Yes. The authors of the bills really are there. They have it stated on their websites. For instance, the American Public Policy Alliance, their website mentions Sharia specifically. And in the legislative discussions, we have different legislators from Kansas discussing how they are inundated with emails saying how Sharia is a problem, how it's a threat to American values, and how we need to have these laws to protect our American freedoms and values, which simply is false because, like Ms. Shabir points out too, we have the U.S. Constitution and the Kansas or Missouri Constitution to protect our individual values.
And Raj Bala, feel free to jump in as well. I guess I'm wondering, are there other religious or non-religious foreign laws that this law could conceivably be talking about? Is there a case where Kansas or Missouri legislators or judges tried to apply some sort of foreign law for legal effect in Kansas or Missouri?
it's illegal.
Well, there could be, and Ryan might know better than I would on that. But I would endorse wholeheartedly what he said, that the their unintended effects, unforeseeable effects of extremist legislation like Article 51.
Well, let's take a question from Larry in Mission. He called us at 816-235-2888, 235-2888. Larry, good morning.
Good morning. I understand very well the reasons against the laws, and I agree with those things. I don't really think the laws should be passed at this time. I'd like to hear more about what the proponents think are the legitimate reasons for passing the laws. I mean, the laws have been passed in several states, and they're selling them to the legislatures in some ways. I'd just like to hear a little bit more about how they're selling these laws.
Sure. Appreciate that question, Larry. Ryan, you are obviously not a proponent of these laws, but you've done a lot of research. Make the strongest case that supporters have for something like Article 51.
I think that supporters for Article 51 and its Missouri counterpart, I think that they want to ensure that the judiciary is going to respect the American Constitution first and the state constitution if applicable, because they want our freedoms and they want our liberties to be preserved in court decisions, and they want those there. And I think they want a security blanket to know that judges are always going to look at the Constitution first and foremost, rather than relying on a foreign law or a foreign policy to even influence a decision or look at a decision.
From a legal standpoint, Ryan, is such a security blanket of any legal effect? Does it help? Does it matter?
No, we already have these protections afforded to us by the Constitution, and judges already take an oath to uphold the Constitution in their decisions. They may look at what other countries are doing around the world and how they influence our decisions, but we don't really rely on foreign judgments per se to hold, you know, individual decisions before a judge.
Sure. So, Manoj, go ahead, Raj.
I could jump in there, I think that what Ryan's saying is very important, because there's no legal effect that's healthy that comes out of this. And to the contrary, it is quite damaging, sometimes economically or potentially economically. I mean, first of all, the legislation's disingenuous, because to say that a judge can't base his decision on foreign law is to presume that the American legal system developed in a petri dish by itself with no foreign influences, that the founding fathers weren't thinking about English law or Roman law or other influences, and that they haven't come into our legal system across the two centuries or through treaty law. And in fact, there are many doctrines in Islamic law that bear quite close similarities to U.S. law. For example, a basic idea of a contract, how you form a contract, you need offer, acceptance, and consideration. Well, that's in Islamic law long before there was an Anglo-American legal system. But in terms of the negative effects, what this does in an era of globalization when Kansas and Missouri are trying to attract businesses and talented, cosmopolitan, highly educated people to their states, is it turns them off. It sends a signal that we are an intolerant part of the country and that they'd be better off going to California or New York or another state that doesn't entertain such extremist legislation. It also adds a burden to Kansas, and if it's passed in Missouri or if it's an act in Missouri judges, because as Ryan suggested, the judge is not supposed to enforce any element of something that looks like foreign law if we would not have the same right or protection in the United States or under state law. So actually the judge now has to do a threefold examination. First, he has to look at what's the right or privilege at stake under the foreign legal system? How would it be protected? What's the right or stake, right or privilege under state law? How would it be protected? And how would that same right or privilege be protected under U.S. law? So you do a threefold examination, which triples a judge's burden at a time when we're trying to streamline government and dealing with budget crises. We're putting more of a burden on the judges.
So,
absolutely,
Manaz,
unnecessarily.
Manaz, I want to ask you, if it's not necessary from a legal standpoint, and if, as Raj says, there are actually some consequences to it, what do you think is really driving this? What is this law really about?
Right. Again, it goes to this fear about what Islam is and that we're trying to take over the United States, that kind of craziness. I would say also it's a way of these legislators to create a smokescreen, to create a rallying piece amongst their constituents who are kind of, you know, that don't have the good education about Islam, instead of putting the attention on where it needs to be. And as a taxpayer, I'm going to say, where are we in our education? Where are we in our health care? Where are we in our crime? I mean, this is where our legislators should be putting their emphasis on, because obviously we don't need this law because we already have something that's so much better called the U.S. Constitution.
Senator Jolie Justice of Kansas City told the Kansas City Star last week that for years the Democratic caucus in the state Senate actually blocked this legislation, but this year said that they wanted to show what the priorities of the majority were, and she made some of the same arguments you just did, that there are other priorities that should be held as more important. Let's take some calls. 816-235-2888. Babir in Leavenworth. Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to Central Center. Go ahead.
My question was that being a Muslim myself and how some other countries or other nations interpreted Sharia, for example, we could talk about the Taliban, about the education-wise or people that steal, how they deal with them and things like that. Well, what we were taught is very different than some people that with the way they practice. For example, what I was taught was the day that you're born until the day you die, you're supposed to get education for men and women, just not men, but women. But like people like the Taliban, they put such an emphasis on making sure that women do not get education. So my thing is I want to direct the question to you guys. What are your thoughts on different nations interpreting different Sharia law?
Thanks for the question, Babir. Raj, I mean, Sharia means different things in different places, it seems.
Yeah, and some of those meanings, as Babir's excellent question suggests, are utterly un-Islamic. They're not authentically Islamic. The very tradition, the sunnah of the Prophet, and many statements in the Holy Quran make clear about equality of men and women and the importance of educating girls as well as boys, and the use of an interpretation to deny those passages and those teachings is not consistent with Islam. And that part of the educational battle, if I might put it that way, that is being fought is not only in the non-Muslim world, but also in the Muslim world. That is to say, helping differentiate fact from fiction. Authentic teachings and reasonable variations in interpretation from extremist and unauthentic interpretations. That's something that's going on in countries like Afghanistan.
A couple of questions on Twitter here. We have one from John who tweets, should religious freedom allow laws defining financial transactions, or does that cross a line between religion and public policy? Does it make sense to talk about Islamic laws about financial transactions as part of the American financial system?
Well, in Islamic banking law, there are two grand principles. One is against excessive risk taking, and the other is against interest or at least usurious interest rates. And there are elements of those sorts of rules in our own banking law system against excessive risk-taking by banks. We're dealing with that right now on what kinds of transactions can they engage in and to what extent, and should there be caps on their liabilities.
Right. Apparently not enforced enough in the past.
Not enforced enough, exactly. And we have concerns in our own consumer banking sector about payday loans and usurious interest rates on them. So it's already an issue. And in one case, it's sourced in Quran and Sunnah. In another case, it's sourced in our own federal and state banking laws.
Manas?
Yeah, I was going to say that if our financial institutions in the United States would want to adopt some of this just to help with other Muslim organizations so they can build their mosques or schools or what have you, I mean, they would want to have these kind of folks as to lend to, because they don't want to have a loan. They want to pay it off in cash as much as possible. So, I mean, it's like this is the best of both worlds of a low-risk entity.
Ryan Boyer, you don't just argue that the laws are unnecessary or even that they have some unintended consequences. You actually argue that these are unconstitutional. Why is that?
Well, I think largely it's unconstitutional if under many provisions of the Constitution, but also mostly under the Establishment Clause. As Ms. Shabir talks about earlier, she states that we have the right as individuals to practice whatever religion we want. But also, this seems to advance all religions but Islam, because if we look at the intent behind this bill and the actual purpose, it's nothing but a sham, really, and all it wants to do is prohibit individuals to practice Islam, Sharia, in their everyday contracts and life. And I think that's the main reason why it would fail the Establishment Clause scrutiny.
Yeah, I appreciate all those comments, because it's it is attacking Islam, and our Constitution is, you know, we have equal rights for all, and not to discriminate on religion. But I also want to just put in a website for folks who want to know more that we weren't able to get to, and it's called Sharia101.org. And you can go to this website and get a lot more information. You can even print off pamphlets if you liked and give it to your minister if that minister is preaching something about anti-Sharia. Because the thing is that this is where we have to start. We have to start educating our friends and our neighbors and our colleagues that, you know, when you say anti-Sharia, you're really saying anti-American almost, because you're attacking any religion that is in the United States.
And we will have a link to that brochure available on our website, which is kcur.org. Go ahead, Raj.
Brian, to pick up on an entrepreneurial possibility that this kind of anti-Sharia legislation quelches, and this goes back to the previous caller, is Islamic banking. In many countries, and often by banks from the Western world, we have what are called dual banking systems or dual windows, where the banks offer conventional non-Muslim Western financial products that have interest and maybe have a little higher level of risk, and Islamic financial products that do not involve interest and maybe have a little lower level of risk and are structured as partnerships. Now, there is an increasing interest, as we've seen since the financial crisis, in more ethically based investment schemes. We've not yet seen banks in Kansas or Missouri. I understand there may be one or two small community banks in Michigan who've done this, have set up Islamic windows. Well, you know, almost kudos to the first bank that first set of banks that starts doing those and sets up a dual window system. They're going to garner a lot of business, probably from Muslims and non-Muslims alike, but for this kind of legislation that has the turnoff effect.
Let's take one more question from Rick in Kansas City. Rick, good morning. Welcome to Central Standard.
Good morning. How are you today? Thank you for having this program. My comment was, and I would appreciate hearing from your panel, as an American, I truly abhor this total discussion by our legislatures. It's a waste of time, energy, and money, and I think it's offensive. However, I believe some of it is engendered by Americans individually and collectively reacting to the violence that is so often associated with parts of the Muslim world. And I have heard publicly parts of the American community, and certainly from
Rick, I need you to ask it quickly, or we won't have time for the panel.
That the locale where that was taking place, or the ruling was taking place, is up to that local area, and we do not hear the voice of passion from our American counterparts that abhor the violence and disavow it in all forms. And I just think that that's part of the American response, unfortunately.
Rick, thank you, Manoj.
This is a common comment that's made since 9/11, and that we haven't made our voices heard. And believe me, Rick, we have been. We've been putting statements out from all areas of the country. It's just that the media doesn't always pick it up because, you know, it's not sensationalized that we denounce something. It's more sensationalized that these things are happening in another part of the world. So just know that, believe that, because that's true.
Thanks for the call, Rick, and we are out of time. That's Manoj Shabir. She's a local leader in the Muslim community and part of the Kansas City Interfaith Council. Thank you for being here, Manoj.
You're welcome.
We've also had with us Raj Bala, a professor at KU Law School and a teacher of a class on Islamic law. Thanks for being with us, Raj.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And joining us by phone from Dallas is Ryan Boyer, who just graduated from law school this weekend and will have a KU Law Review article about the passage of Article 51 in Kansas. Thanks for being with us, Ryan.
Thank you again.
We should mention we did contact Governor Jay Nixon's office to ask if he would be signing the law that is passed in Missouri, but he did not respond to us by the time we went on the air today. You can subscribe to our podcast or hear this conversation again or any of our previous shows at kcur.org. Join us tomorrow as we explore the new domesticity. Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton with Suzanne Hogan. Special thanks to KCUR's Alex Smith for his reporting on this story and KC Currents. Up to Date is next with comedian Jim Gaffigan. I'm Brian Ellison, and this is Central Standard.